Our guest Lee Elders now regaling us with stories about running through the jungle, walking through the jungle, stumbling through it, filled with all sorts of dangers that we haven't even touched on yet, snakes and big cats and headhunters, things of that sort, all to find gold and later to find an even bigger treasure, emeralds. This story involves an ancient map to a lost fortune in emeralds. We'll get into that part of the story right after this on Coast to Coast AM. So Lee Elders, to recap, you go down to South America, you have this first expedition that you helped organize, you walk into this this remote area and come back with coffee cans filled with gold and gold nuggets. Second operation, you figure, let's go set up a dredging operation. We hire 50 people, we got a bunch of equipment, we're going to go in and do this big time. Who owned that land? Were there any rights involved or mining rights at the time that you had to worry about?
Oh, no, not at all. It was wide open land. I had Adriano check it out. There were no claims in there. There were no concessions, anything like that. It was just wild land. And only a few people in the village there knew about it, and only a few more had ever gone there. And they said I was the first white man that ever went there. And anyway, we had success on that first adventure. The second one turned out bad because of betrayal on the trail. But I finally was able to retrieve my men, get them out of there. And so Bob Olson and I, my friend from Yuma, my visa was about to expire. So I had to leave the country to renew my visa, and also I'd lost something like 30 pounds. And so we left, we came home. And after I got back into Phoenix and got my health back and everything, I received a letter one day from Adriano Ventimiglia, my translator friend that was helping me there. And it was probably, he started out by saying, "This is the most important letter you'll ever receive." Well, that got my attention, of course. And then he started to explain how he had come in contact with the last will and testament of a man named Rafael Bolanos Mejia, who had found emeralds in the Oriente. And he wanted me to come back and help him search for them. And he closed the letter by saying, if God is with us and we can find this treasure, it will change the political and economic structure of my country." I mean, that's how important the emeralds were at that time to him. And then when I returned, I found out exactly what he was talking about, because the story itself was fascinating. It was well documented. And, of course, that really turned us on even more. It wasn't just some tale or story.
Let's talk about that, well documented, because, you know, you know from living here in the Southwest, there are all kinds of treasure stories and treasure maps that turn out to be not true. What was it about this story that lent it credibility in your mind?
Several things. First of all, the last will and testament, it told the story about how he had found it.
Well, talk about who he is. Yeah.
Okay. Rafael Mejia, how he had found the emeralds. He was working as a hunter for a quinine harvesting company that was working deep in the jungle, harvesting quinine that was sent back to Quito and eventually by sailing vessel to Europe. And one day while he was working as a hunter for the group working there, he tracked a bear on a ledge, finally cornered it. He shot it with his shotgun, killed it. Well, the bear started tumbling when he was shot. He tumbled off the ridge, and in this tumbling, he started to break up foliage and also break rock loose from the ledge. And it was a white matrix-type rock. So while he was While he was dressing the carcass out, he noticed, Mejia noticed that there was, in this white matrix, there was green. And the green stones in the matrix were sparkling in the sun. So he immediately thought, wow, if this is tourmaline, I've made more right here in what I can pick out of the rock than a year of working here as a hunter for this harvesting group. But anybody who's searched for emeralds knows that tourmaline is very deceptive. You don't know if you found emerald or found tourmaline. He felt he had found tourmaline. But in the back of his mind, he also knew that if it were emerald, then he would be rich beyond his wildest dreams. So he took his machete, started chopping out this rock, chopping the matrix out, and finally dulled his machete. And this is all in letters he sent to his family. We're reading the letters in his last will and testament. Then he used his shotgun, the butt of his shotgun, to try to break more pieces loose. Finally, he had three specimens. One was about an inch in length, beautiful green fire. The Spaniards referred to the emeralds as the green fire stones, and that's where the green fire comes from my book. But anyway, he took the samples back to this area where they live called the Tambo Santa Rosa, which meant Tambo in Quechua meant tambu, which means house. By the river called the Santa Rosa. And he delivered the bear meat to the cook. But before he left, I might add, he estimated that this stone that contained the emeralds, this large rock, was, he wrote in his diary, was tres arrobas, which means about 75 pounds. So now he takes off his coat, and he wraps it around this rock, and he starts dragging it. And he's trying to find a hiding place for it. So he finally found, as he described it, a rock, a large rock, open in the middle. So he drug the stone up into the rock, left it there, buried it with other stones, and went to camp, turned over his samples to his foreman, a man named Baraña. And Baraña said he would send them to Quito, which he did. And so the stones were sent to Quito. And then by sailing vessel, they went to Paris, France, to a laboratory there called the Semprus Molina Laboratory. So in the meantime, Mejia, well, he knew this would take months before he got analysis on them to find out what he had actually found. So he went back to work. He forgot about it. But within weeks of going back to work, the Ecuadorian military came in and conscripted the entire workforce into the military and sent them to Quito to fight in the revolution there. There was a revolution going on between General Selassie and General Ventimiglia. Now, my friend Adriano Ventimiglia, I would find out later that this was a relative of his. General Ventimiglia was president of Ecuador in the 1800s. Mejia had found his stones in 1881. So now he's in Guayaquil. He gets caught in a battle there, an artillery duel. And in the process, he loses a leg. On top of that, he's fighting for the losing side. And after the battle is over with and the war is over with, he is exiled from Ecuador back to his native country of Colombia. Excuse me. So here he is, a one-legged man in Colombia. He can't get back to his emerald find. And so he tries to enlist support and help and all that, but he can't find any. In 1887, he's getting much older. He knows that he has to establish a will and testament. And under Ecuadorian law, you have to mention or describe all of your holdings. And of course, he considered the emerald mine his. And so he had to list it in his last will and testament. But by that time, he had people that knew he'd found emeralds, and they were trying everything to get to the source. He knew if he gave them the exact location, they would find it. He would be out of it. So he contrived a riddle in his last will and testament for his family. And that riddle was strange in itself. It was veiled innuendos of where this mine might be. So now we're in contact with the last will and testament, and we start researching, Adriano and I, in the city of Cuenca. We go to the Army base. We check their maps. We find the map in the Army base that lists the Rio Santa Rosa, listing the river where Mejia said he had found the stones. In that process, we also found a Catholic priest named Padre Crespi, who told us that he found white matrix and emeralds in the white matrix, and he took us into his museum there. He showed us everything. I took a picture of it. The photograph is in the book. But here we have two sources. We have Mejia's last will and testament, naming the area and what he found. We have a Catholic priest saying that he found white matrix with green stones in them, emeralds. So now we're pretty convinced that the main river is the Rio Tutanangosa, and the side river where Mejia killed the bear is the Santa Rosa River. So now we start making plans on how to get there.
You also had confirmation in the sense that you or someone had really did track down where the original emerald samples that he found were sent. Who purchased them? I guess the experts who confirmed that they were in fact emeralds and what the purchase price was. I mean, that all stuff really did happen.
That is correct. And reading the latter pages in his book, we found letters that indicated where those stones went after the Sempris Molina laboratory examined them. The report that came back was that they were high-grade emeralds, and apparently news traveled fast from the Kenyera Mining Company out of Quito. There was two British men that worked in politics and with the British government in Quito. They heard about it. They went to Baranya. Now, Baranya winds up with Mejia's emerald, and he sells it to a British man named Hamilton for 300 gold pesos, which was a king's ransom back then. And so Mejia never got paid for the emeralds he entrusted with the camp foreman. And so we read about that in the last will and testament, how those letters came into being. I don't know. The book that we had was actually, it was an old book, but there was only two pages. The first two pages was the last will and testament, and they had been placed in the book for preservation's sake. Now, there were 7 pages after that, almost 10 pages, I'd say 10 pages, where you had family letters going back and forth. Some of them Mejia had written, others he hadn't. And then the last 70 pages of the book, all it dealt with was progress in the Oriente, road building and mining and farming. So basically it was only about 12 pages that really contained information about the emeralds. And it was in the last will and testament.
Let's talk about the emeralds in general. You give me some tantalizing pieces of info that I didn't know about the rarity, the specialness of emeralds compared to other kinds of treasures, and why Ecuador would be a place you would look for a fantastic trove of emeralds.
Well, it begins with the Inca. The Incas had emeralds in their palaces. They had gold adorned with the green stones. So when Pizarro landed and wanted to conquer the Incas, he was met by Inca dignitaries when they stepped off their boat near Tumbes in Peru, and he was gifted with emeralds as well as some gold, because the legend was, according to the Inca king, who supposedly had a dream, that the bearded ones were coming across the sea, and these were gods, and they were coming to help the Incas. Well, instead, it was Pizarro's band of brigands who came in with, 160 men or something, and conquered an entire nation. Now, they knew that the Incas knew where their mines were, their emerald mines, because the Incas were working very heavily in emeralds. They had stashed away a lot of them. They had adorned their palaces with them. And the Spaniards tried everything to get this information.
Torture.
First they tried religion. They tried to convert them, baptize them, conversion, and have them tell them. That didn't work. And then they started torturing them. That didn't work. None of them revealed the source of the emeralds. So we knew Ecuador, parts of Peru, were probably emerald producers. We knew for a fact that Colombia was, because one of the rarest and most expensive and high-quality emerald in the world came out of the Muzo mine, which is outside of Bogota in Colombia. So we knew that the area supported that type of thing, supported emeralds. And then Mejia's find. Now, today, we don't know. Mejia did not say it was a Inca mine. All he said was it was this large rock that had broke loose. So we feel that probably it was just an outcropping, a natural outcropping of emeralds that he was lucky enough to find. I doubt very seriously it was an Inca mine.
There's no way to even put a dollar amount, not even a guess, on something like that, what it would be worth.
Oh, no, no, not at all. Because they're very rare. today you can get you can find more emeralds outside of the Muzo mine. They're finding a good quality emerald in Africa now, but the Muzo is still king, and Mejia's 1-inch emerald that went to Sempras Molina in Paris, I mean, they said it was high quality. So when you're getting into high quality, you're getting into purity. And they call it green fire because the more quality you have to an emerald, the more the sunlight will dance within the green stone. And so they're very, very valuable. Very valuable.
One of the, I forget which of the explorers, but there was a great quote in your book. I don't remember which one said it, but one of the explorers said something to the effect of, "You can keep all the gold that's in Ecuador. Just, we want the emeralds." Who was that?
That was Pizarro, and that's on record in Spain. He had with him, his expedition had a monk or a friar named Sanchez, who represented the court as well as the church. And Sanchez, on record, wrote this about the first meeting. And apparently you can find this if you go to Madrid. You know what books to look for. You can find Sanchez's accounts of the Pizarro expedition. But Pizarro did tell him, he said, "Look, just give me the green stones." And he says, "Ollie, you can have all the gold."
Oh, my gosh. Well, we're talking with Lee Elders, author of the book Expeditions, Gold, Shamans, and Green Fire. You've just heard the description of why he got interested in the story about the emeralds. But the search continues because they ran into all sorts of problems. We'll get into that when we continue here on Coast to Coast AM. We're roaming of sorts with Lee Elders, author of the book Expeditions, Gold, Shamans, and Green Fire, searching through the jungles and mountains of Ecuador in search of gold and emeralds and, in a sense, truth. There are supernatural aspects to this story, and when we come back, we'll get into that part of the tale. Stay with us. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. Lee Elders, we realize that this is not travel for the timid, that any kind of a venture out into the jungle is going to have problems. But as you learned on each of your trips, each of your expeditions, there were all sorts of trouble. It was almost like you were cursed at some stage of the way. How much credence did you give the idea of, the beliefs of the natives, that there was some sort of a spell that had been cast to interfere with your journeys? How much you gave it in the beginning, and then how much credence you gave it later?
Second, George, I want to talk about the challenge of just getting there.
Sure.
And I'm talking about into the supernatural world of the headhunters of the Western Amazon. First, we had the challenge of breaking down the riddle of the Last Will and Testament. Mejia was very clever, so clever that his family couldn't even find it. But it read like this. Now, we knew that the river, name of the river, where the rock, the large 75 pounds, was buried in a larger rock. And we knew that 400 yards away on a hill was the outcropping. We knew that. But these rivers are big, and they meander like snakes, so we had to break more of the puzzle in his Last Will and Testament down, and it started with this. He said, like making a relation, the entrance, and we're assuming he's talking about the entrance to this mine and where this rock is buried, the entrance is by the Cascabel, and it takes crossing the first river upstream. Now, what in the world did like making a relation mean? That puzzled us. But the big, big problem was Cascabel. We researched every dictionary we could find, Spanish dictionary. I'm talking about Adriano and I. And the Cascabel had three meanings. One, it was the knob on the end of a cannon. Two, it was a bell. And three, it was the name of a snake that resided in the Oriente. It was called the Cascabel. It was like our rattlesnake in the Southwest because it made a rattling sound before it struck. So those were the three things we had to solve before we ever made our first trip in. And it took weeks and weeks, and finally we just were about to give up, and I had returned to the States to regroup and all of that. And in one of my trips, a friend of mine who was into psychics told me about this psychic in Phoenix operating out of a club called the, I can't think of the name of it right now, but his profession, his specialty was psychometry. And luckily, I had the Last Will and Testament with me, and I went to the nightclub, and I tied a shoestring around the book. I sent it up on stage. Dr. Richard Ireland was the psychic performing, and he would read, he would give readings on earrings, scarves. Anybody'd send anything up, he'd tell you all about yourself and things of this nature. Well, I waited and waited, and finally, he asked if I was in the audience. I said, yes. He says, I have a book here. And I might add, before he starts his act, he places tape over his eyes, gauze over the eyes, and then tape over that, and then he puts a hood over his head. And all he deals with is his hands and what impressions he gets in his mind. Well, in doing this, he blew me away because he named two rivers that were in the book that we had to cross to get upstream to the area we were going to. Now, how would he know this?
When I read that in your book, I thought, holy cow, this guy's good.
He really was. And later, after that session, which was brief because it was a nightclub act, and I made arrangements the next day to come back and have a private reading, which I did. He gave me a lot more information, and he told me that, like making a relation, he saw Mejia, he described Mejia to me. He says he was a very articulate man. He made very few mistakes. He was named, his nickname was named El Sapo, and he went through all the details that nobody knew except me and Adriano and a few others and Cuenca. But he told me that, like making a relation, he says you have to relate this to that, to something in a progressive manner in order to get to the second clue, which was the cascabel. He felt the cascabel was a waterfall of some sort. And the entrance, he says, I don't see a cave. He says, I just see that once you relate this to that to this, you will finally get to the point or the entryway in to find the rock and the stones. He estimated the value of the rock alone, the 75 pounds of emerald-laden rock, at about $12 million. Now, this is back in the 60s, okay? So I had that information coming back to Ecuador for a second run, and now was the second challenge. The second challenge was getting there, and the big problem with that is there were no roads then. The Ecuadorian government was building a road, but it was still under construction. The only way you could get in was fly, and that was either by DC-3 with the Ecuadorian military or by charter. And that in itself was a daunting task because the weather back sometimes would wait weeks before we could fly. And like I said earlier, they were losing a lot of aircraft. But anyway, we overcame that obstacle. We finally got into the area for our first extended expedition. And luckily, our advance party, weeks earlier, had run into a man. His name was Antonio Necta. He owned the land that we had to cross to get upstream, to follow the Rio Tutunegosa upstream to the Rio Santa Rosa. And so we asked permission if we could cross his land, and he granted that permission. But in doing so, he became a very good friend. And later I would find out that he was a shaman and very well respected by the entire Shuar community. But his specialty in shamanism, he was a curer, what they call a Paner Uwisen. And there were two types of shaman. There was a good shaman, and he was one of them. He was a curer. And there was a bad shaman. And those were what they call the bewitchers. And these shamans would cast spells and basically just use a lot of black magic to create whatever they wanted to create at the time. And I had heard these stories about them, and I was a little bit leery, hoping I wouldn't run into a Wawick. They were called Wawicks. And Antonio Necta, my guide and my friend, told me not to worry. Everything would be okay. And I really think about that today because I've had people say, God, I want to go down there and look for these. And the first thing I tell them is, if you go, make sure you have a shuara with you that's well-respected. Don't go in alone, because I don't think you'll come out alive. Because a lot of adventurers, explorers, we learn later, going up into that area, never returned. Now, why, we don't know. But anyway, here we are. We've got a shaman. He's a guide. He knows the area. In fact, his house is up by the river. He had two houses, one in Sakua and one up in the area we're going to. And his house was named Wakani. And Wakani means spirit or spirit bird. And so Necta was leading our expedition. And we made, I might add, we made many expeditions. On some, we returned back because we couldn't cross certain rivers. One bad river we always had problems with was the Rio Tigris. And beyond the Tigris, we had been warned by Necta that once we got into that area beyond the Tigris is where the jaguar lived. And the jaguars were muy brava, very brave. And they were hungry up there. They'd killed out a lot of the game. And we had heard that they hunted in packs. Now, this is unheard of. You can research jaguars all day long, and you'll find out that, well, they don't hunt in packs. That's very rare. But I've talked to many Indians who said that groups were attacked by four or five jaguars at one time. Later, I would find out that according to the Shuara, and I might add, I'm using names here. Let me back up and tell you what the names mean. The Hebrew is the name given to those tribes, but they were given to it by the Western world. Hebrew meant savage. The Hebrew hated this name, so they adopted a new name. The tribe that I was working with were called the Unta Shua, and the Shuara means man, men, or people. It was a more civilized term. So the Shuara and the Hebrew are the same, but you didn't address a Shuara as a Hebrew. They hated that. So the Shuara became my friends, and I hired cargo carriers, Shuara cargo carriers, and we finally made it up to the Tigris, and I think it was our third or fourth try, and that's when all hell broke loose in their life.
Yeah, there's a story you tell toward the end of the book about what amounts to a confrontation with evil. That's why when I was asking the question I asked earlier, how much credence you gave to the whole idea about spirits interfering with your trips. You know, it's difficult under the best circumstances, but you had extra special challenges, it seemed like, every step of the way. And it kind of culminates with this one battle. If you want to describe that, maybe that'll allow you to answer the question I had in mind.
Yeah, this one battle in the book, it's called the, I think you're referring to the chapter called The Power Dance.
Yes.
And, yeah. And we had made it up past the Tigris. We had no problems with cats, no problems with snakes. Snakes was my biggest fear because there were so many different types there, and all of them were deadly. And when you're going through these trailless areas and you're chopping and so forth, eventually you get so tired you don't give a damn. I mean, you could get bit, you wouldn't even know it, because you're always getting hit by sticker vines and other things that are puncturing the skin. But I had heard the stories about the Wawiks and how they could manipulate animals, how they could manipulate weather and other things. And I thought, well, that's interesting. But then when I found out firsthand that this was very true, something very strange was going on up there, I started paying and giving more credence to the supernatural world of the shaman up in that area. And this one trip we were on, we'd crossed the river, and there was five of us. And like I say, our lead was Necta. And I had another man, a Shuara. He was a warrior type. His name was Ambusha. And we'd crossed, we'd made camp. And I said, wow, tomorrow we'll be in Kayanade number one. And the Kayanade is where it was the name of an area in the Moccas Forest that was where we thought Mahia had found the emeralds. And Ambusha cautioned me, and he says, no. He says, we can't camp in there. He says, the spirits won't allow us to. said, okay, how do we get permission? He says, we can do it one of two ways. He says, we can take ayahuasca and talk to the spirits, or else I will talk to them in dream state tonight. So I told him, okay, you talk in dream state tonight. I wasn't about to get stoned on ayahuasca in this part of the world. Very hallucinogenic drink. But that night, next morning, he told us that we could chop up to kyanide number two, but under no circumstances were we to spend the night in there. And we asked why. He said, because the spirits won't allow it. And he says, the Niawas, the jaguar, that's what they call the jaguar, the Niawas are hungry, and we don't want to stay in there at night. I said, okay, we will not spend the night in there. Well, the next day, we lost track of time, and we found out that, my God, we're not going to be back, get back to our base camp in this safe zone. We're going to have to spend the night in this area where the spirits told us not to spend the night, and that's what we had to do. Luckily, before dark, we found a crevice in the side of a riverbank, and we hunkered down in there. We grabbed firewood alongside the river, dry wood. We built a firewall around this crevice, this small little cave we were in, and we prepared for the evening. And I was told by Necta that they would come for us at the first full moon. And I asked him, I said, now, are you talking about something real? I mean, it's physical, and they're going to come out and attack us. And he says, they're as real as you and I are. And he says, under no circumstances are we to fire our weapons unless absolutely necessary, because the forest guardians will come out to dictate our fate. Well, about midnight, the first moon came out. We heard this whistling sound in the trees, almost like a flute, like flute sounds. And they're all around us, above us, behind us. And I asked Necta, I said, what is this? And he said that they were what they call the parrot snakes. They're a tree viper, and they hunt nesting birds at night. Well, here we are. We're camped right in the heart of one of the fiercest vipers in the jungle. We're in their domain, and they're above us. They're hunting birds in the trees, and we're below. And all of a sudden, it became pretty bleak because they were killing a lot of birds. There was a lot of haunting cries going on from the birds trying to escape them. And I saw a snake that glided down across the edge of the cave by Necta's shoulders and glided out into the darkness. And I yelled at Necta, I said, set the fire, set the fire. So he did. And now we got a fire going and the smoke and everything. All of a sudden, the shrill shrieks from the parrot snakes and the flute sounds are getting fainter and fainter. They're moving away from their worst enemy, which is fire and smoke.
Yeah, but this is not just a couple of snakes you're hearing across the river. The whole trees were shaking and limbs, and this sounded like an invasion of snakes in the trees, right?
Oh, they're all around us, above us, everywhere.
I'll tell you what, Lee, we have to pick up the story on the other side of the break here, and we'll get into a couple of other interesting aspects of your expeditions into the jungle there, the search for treasure, and then maybe touch on Billy Meyer and open up the phone lines in the next segment. Stay with us, everyone. Much more to come on Coast to Coast AM.